This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
The U.S. presidential election was already wildly contentious. And then last Friday evening, the stakes were elevated even higher and the partisan rancor ratcheted up even more when a certain vacancy opened up on the U.S. Supreme Court. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, as you said, it was last Friday night that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died of pancreatic cancer in her home. She has been the most senior member of the liberal wing of the court. She's appointed to the court by Bill Clinton in 1993, and has been on the court for 27 years, so a pretty long tenure. Was ranked, most judicial rankings put her as, depending on the year, either the most liberal or the second most liberal justice on the Supreme Court. I think the last year, Sotomayor may have narrowly beat her out on the liberal rankings. But all the big liberal decisions. She's always been, when you ever hear those like 5-4 decisions, she's always been on the liberal wing. I know on this program when Anthony Kennedy died, I prepared a list of like all the landmark rulings that he swung to the liberal wing of the court. That's a little harder to do with Ruth Bader Ginsburg because she was not a swing voter. She was always on the liberal side. One of the particular rulings that comes into relevance coming up to an election was her role in the Bush v. Gore ruling in the year 2000. That was when the election was contested. Florida was doing recounts. The Supreme Court had to step in and basically rule that what Florida was doing was illegal. The way they were doing these recounts was designed to change the election results, and so the Supreme Court ruled, I think it was 6-3 in favor of George Bush, but Ginsburg wrote, I think there were a couple different dissents were written in that case, but she wrote some of the major dissents, saying that Florida should be allowed to continue its activities, which would have put Al Gore in the presidency. And that's actually one of the reasons that President Trump is so keen on getting her seat filled right away, because we're going into what could be a close election. Hopefully it's not so close that the Supreme Court has to get involved, because if the Supreme Court did have to get involved in this election, it would probably be unwise to go into the election with a Supreme Court with only 8 people on it. Because eight is divisible by 2, so you could get yourself in a situation where both the nation and the court was evenly divided. Making sure there's a 9th member on that court kind of gives the nation a fail-safe to make sure that we, or hopefully make sure that we know who's president come January 20th.
Right, except that if the Ginsburg seat is replaced by a constitutional originalist, the composition of the court changes dramatically, and the left are essentially apoplectic about this prospect.
Yeah, I was reading some of the ideological scorings of the different justices, and it looks like if it is Amy Barrett or someone like her from the Federalist Society, that it could actually swing the composition to the Supreme Court to being the most conservative it's been since 1950. So that's like the most conservative it's been in 70 years, which does have some long-term ramifications for our society, because American society is not the most conservative it's been since 1950.
Yeah.
And American politics is not the most conservative it's been since 1950. But the Supreme Court might end up being the most conservative it's been since 1950. So you can imagine there may be some rulings that are constitutionally legal, good rulings that people aren't going to like.
Yeah.
I mean, you're even seeing, I'm seeing articles about, like, you remember how horrible the left slurred Brett Kavanaugh and all the protest over him. And now they're saying that, like, Brett Kavanaugh is going to be the new swing vote. So if the radical left wants any liberal decisions, they better try to kiss and make up, because it's, yeah, he's going to kind of have the balance of power in some of these, in some of these scenarios. So yeah, you can definitely, I mean, I'm sure there will be, people already threatened protest over just getting a constitutional justice on the court. But then, like, you start making some anti-abortion rulings or some of the rulings that aren't what the left wants in terms of, like, homosexual rights or other issues, healthcare. You could definitely see riots and civil unrest that we've been almost getting used to this summer mm-hmm. become almost like a permanent feature of American society.
Yeah, you have really a couple of things going on here with the swing to the conservative side on the of the composition of the court. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how that factors into Bible prophecy. But then you also have the left feeling more and more disenfranchised and willing to basically burn the system to the ground because they don't feel like it represents them.
Right. And yeah, with Bible prophecy, I think later on in the program, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the riots going on in America right now. And quoting a scripture that we commonly quote these days in Isaiah 1:7 about your cities burning with fire. And so, I mean, that's a prophecy that we're seeing fulfilled, and we're probably seeing fulfilled more and more and more as this divide between the court and the radical left grows. But then there's also a prophecy in Amos 7, verses 12 through 13, that we'll put an article in the show notes, is the Supreme Court and Bible Prophecy, by our editor-in-chief, that will explain that in more detail. But it's basically talking about an end time type of King Jeroboam, who the article explain is President Trump is the end time type. But the verse talks about the king's chapel and the kingdom. Well, it says the king's chapel and the king's court. It would be better translated the king's chapel and the kingdom's court. So that's talking about a chapel or a religious movement and a court that are aligned with this ruler in end time Israel. Now, the fact that it says king's chapel shows that that religious movement will be closely aligned with that end time ruler. But the kingdom's court, I mean, that doesn't seem like it's necessarily extremely partisan to the person of the king, but it's still aligned with him in a lot of ways. And so, as the article about the is the Supreme Court and Bible prophecy proves, that Amos 7's really talking about this government structures, not the Supreme Court and some of the deep state agencies and some of these buildings in the Washington D.C. Plaza that have been historically very hostile to President Trump coming more on side. And so you start to see six conservative justices that you're going to have more rulings favoring the Trump administration, as opposed to some of the rulings we've seen for the past year, where President Obama passes a executive order to deport immigrants and the court loves it, and President Trump tries to overturn it and they say that he can't do that for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen Flory, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show host, has been covering some of the ramifications of what the replacement justice on the Supreme Court will mean for America. You can listen to his radio programs from the past week. He also wrote an article that appeared up on the website on Monday, Battleground, the Supreme Court. Go check that out, and definitely we will keep our eyes on how this unfolds in America in fulfillment of these prophecies that we've been highlighting for quite some time. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. The after effects of the Abraham Accords continue to ripple through the Middle East, the deal between Israel and a couple of its Arab neighbors. We'll talk about another one in the second half of the program. First, though, we'll talk about a deal that will put American stealth jets in the hands of these Arabs. For this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there were rumors of this deal actually as soon as the peace deal was announced back on August 13th. And that is that for UAE to come together with Israel and to normalize relations, that they would also be receiving the latest jet from the United States, the F-35. And this has been downplayed, obviously, by the Prime Minister of Israel. He said that this was not a party to the talks that he was involved in. And yet, as time has gone on, it has showed that this was part of the quid pro quo that actually got the UAE to the table to sign this deal with Israel. This was confirmed by the fact that the Defense Minister of Israel, Benny Gantz, was in Washington this week with Defense Secretary Esper, and they were trying to coordinate a way in which the F-35 could be sold to the UAE and potentially other Arab states, and that Israel would still maintain its qualitative military edge. This is something that the United States has agreed to. It's got a law for this, and just huge historic precedent that would ensure that Israel has superior military power than anyone else in the region to make sure it can defend itself if it has to. And right now, Israel is the only nation inside the Middle East with the F-35 since early 2018. It's used it on Iranian targets inside Syria. And critically, this is an airplane or jet that can evade any type of radar detection as it's crossing into a country. Right now, Israel could not detect, at least we know that we know of, the F-35 coming into its territory. And so this is extremely dangerous for the state of Israel and something that they are worried now that since the F-35 is going to the UAE, that perhaps others are going to get it as well. And who knows, eventually this is a technology that could be used on the state of Israel from one of these Gulf states.
Israel is understandably alarmed at this and would have resisted this, even though this it appears this was necessary to make this peace deal. But this, what America is saying, that we want to preserve Israel's qualitative military edge over the Arabs. How much reassurance does that give Israel in these conditions?
Well, Israel probably has a little bit of time. It'll take maybe 5 years, something like that, or maybe shorter under Trump presidency to actually get the jets to the UAE. And in that time, Israel could concoct some type of technological advancement in which it could start to detect their infiltration, these jets' infiltration into its airspace. And so Israel right now, as the UAE and all the other Gulf states, they're not thinking about this being used on one another. For the time being, they are thinking about how this would be used against the Iranian adversary that they're both scared of. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think Israelis, the public, are willing to give it a pass, just because this is not an enemy right now. However, if you look at history, there were F-16s that were lined up to go to the Iranian regime in 1979 and 1978. They would have arrived, and that was when, you know, that's when the Shah was in power. The deal was inked when the Shah was in power. And then if the Iranian Revolution happened in 1981 instead of 1979, you would have had the Ayatollah with brand new F-16s that would have been better than what Israel had. And so the Middle East is a dangerous place, and one ally one day could be an adversary if there is a regime change the next. And so these weapons have a habit of, especially ones that the United States floods into the region, being used against Israel. And there is a chance, and a very good chance, looking at biblical prophecy, that they would be used against Israel today, these fighter jets.
So looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, this definitely gives us an understanding of why this is so dangerous that Israel isn't looking at. But can you explain that?
Yeah, and I think people should really watch our editor-in-chief's Key of David program from this weekend. It talks about the danger and the fatal flaw in this deal with Israel and the UAE, because it speaks to what the Bible says and who the real adversaries of Israel are going to be in the end time. Yes, Iran is the adversary right now of both, But the Bible talks about an alliance of nations in Psalm 83 that are going to direct its firepower against Israel. And those nations in Psalm 83 are the Gulf states. They're Jordan. They're the Saudis. They're Turkey even. And what's interesting about this deal is it's not just about F-35 planes for the UAE. If any other nation is going to sign up to a deal with Israel for normalization, as the president says he wants, they are also going to ask for more high-tech weaponry as well. So this is going to flood the Middle East with more sophisticated weapons that were only reserved for the ally of the United States, Israel, that are now going to be inside the hands of the temporary ally of Israel in America, these Arab states. But the Bible says that these very nations are the ones that are going to attack Israel. And so while it's not the intent, of course, what you're seeing now with these weapons going into the hands of the Arab states are the very weapons that are going to be used, no doubt, in that attack against Israel in the future. And again, our editor-in-chief goes into great detail in this in his Key of David program entitled Psalm 83 Prophecy.
Yeah, that really is an excellent point, that this isn't just a one-off, but this sets a precedent for what they've been touting as many deals to come in the future. And it will be interesting to see how many of those Arab states end up benefiting militarily, materially from these deals. Mr. Fleury's program, Psalm 83 Prophecy, that is up on the website right now. We'll also link to an article that Brent wrote about this specifically, Arming Israel's Future Enemy. Check it out in the show notes for this program, or you can probably find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Brent. Russia continues impressive military drills this week as part of a rising anti-West alliance. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Russian President Vladimir Putin is really just beating the war drums right now by staging a few different sets of military drills with just a whole list of its partner nations. So the largest set of exercises is called Caucasus 2020. That one began on Monday, the 21st, and it'll last until Sunday. And as the name implies, it is happening in the southern part of Russia there in the Caucasus region. Parts of it are also happening in the Black and Caspian Seas. And starting today, Putin is personally supervising part of these exercises. And alongside the Russian forces, there are contingents from Armenia, Belarus, China, Iran, Myanmar, and Pakistan. So it's quite a few nations there, and a total of 80,000 people who are involved. And I spoke yesterday with Dr. Vasily Kashin. He's a Moscow-based military analyst, and he said that these drills are mainly focused on testing the command and control system, and especially how well it functions when you've got forces involved from so many different nations all taking part together. And Dr. Kashin also told me that this set of drills would have been even larger this year, except that it was scaled down some because of COVID-19. But it's still a very substantial size for these Caucasus 2020 drills. And then running parallel to them at the same time are the Slavic Brotherhood drills. Those are the war games that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago on Trumpet Hour, taking place in the southwestern part of Belarus. And those games are still going right now. So they've been underway for a couple of weeks now. They involve close to 1,000 Russian and Belarusian troops. And as part of those Slavic Brotherhood games, this week the Russians actually flew two of their 2-160 bombers along Belarus's border with the European Union, so the Belarus-Poland border there. So that's quite a provocative move vis-a-vis Europe. And then early next month, Russia and the other five members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization will hold another set of games inside Belarus. So the other members are Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. So those six will be holding drills in another part of Belarus. So it's just, it's quite a lot of different games that Russia has going on around its periphery. And with these various drills, as you said, Russia is really bringing a lot of its various partner nations together.
Talk about the message that this sends to Europe to be so involved with Belarus in particular.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. You know, I'm sure you noticed that with all three of those drills, Belarus was the one common name that kept coming up. It's the only party that's taking part in all three of these besides Russia. And some analysts are saying that this is Russia trying to show its support for Belarusian president, Mr. Lukashenko. He is wildly unpopular right now. A lot of people are protesting against him because of the elections that he rigged last month to keep himself in power. And this week, the European Union came out and they said they rejected Lukashenko's inauguration. You know, they said his new mandate lacks democratic legitimacy. And that follows announcements by the U.S. and Canada, both saying that they no longer recognize Lukashenko as the head of Belarus. So, you know, Putin, by having this spate of drills and making sure that Belarus's forces are right there beside Russian forces for all three of them, I think Putin is showing the West that he is just, you know, unfazed by those announcements, and he's still standing beside Belarus. But I think actually what Putin's doing here is he's very wisely refraining from taking too much of a side in the internal Belarus conflict. And he's really positioning himself so that he can remain closely aligned with whichever side emerges as the head. So with these drills that he's holding with Belarus, I think it's actually more of a show of Russian solidarity with Belarus in general than it is a show of support for Lukashenko. But in either case, though, Europe is sure to be taking notice of this, and it's a message that I think they'll be concerned about.
Where would you send people to understand this in context of prophecy?
I would send them to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Really puts it all in the context powerfully there.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. The United States is helping Germany to increase its cyber warfare capabilities, but the cooperation between these two powers does come with risks. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think this is a great example of a story that you wouldn't really pay any attention to without the Trumpet's framework for analyzing news events and that framework that's given to us by Bible prophecy. Last month, the newsletter associated with the German military had an article talking about how Germany is stepping up their cooperation in cyber warfare with the United States. It talked about, you know, how they're both facing similar challenges. Obviously, they're both NATO allies. And so it talked about some of the recent developments in cooperation between the two. So towards the end of last year, Germany and America agreed to work more closely in this area. The first half of 2020, they had an agreement they signed, cyber/IT engagement framework. And there was all kinds of liaisons going backwards and forwards between the two. It's not the normal type of headline that really grabs attention, all of these acronyms and various different military officials and bureaucracies shuttling backwards and forwards. The reason why this really caught our attention, though, is that one of the really landmark articles by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury is called America's Achilles Heel and Germany. And the first version of this article he wrote all the way back in the 1990s. And he based it off a comment that an intelligence analyst made, just talking about how cyber warfare is America's Achilles heel. And this is a concern that we've seen just explode over the subsequent years. Lots of people worried about how dependent just about every aspect of the United States military and a lot of other militaries around the world are on cyber warfare. And then not even just the military, but just all the essential parts of everyday life, things like electricity, grids, transportation, just getting food on the shelves. You know, it's all reliant on cyber warfare. So Mr. Fleury wasn't really alone at all in talking about that. Where he was much more unique was in the last part of that article headline, America's Achilles heel and Germany, you know, saying, well, it's not just hackers, say, from Iran or China that we need to be worried about. These are the ones that are much more in the news. But we also need to be concerned about Germany. And so, of course, it catches our eye then when you see these reports about Germany and America stepping up cooperation in cyber warfare, working more closely together, Germany getting an inside look into how America does all of its cyber warfare operations and planning.
You made the point that unless you're looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, you're not necessarily going to give a whole lot of attention to this. What is the prophetic angle to this? Why is this so dangerous, what America is doing here?
Well, there's one very interesting, very specific prophecy in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 7, that says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle." And Mr. Flurry zoomed in on this in that article, and he said, "The trumpet of war is blown in Israel, mainly in Britain and America. It seems that everybody is expecting our people to go into battle, you know, and then it doesn't happen." And he asked, well, will that be because of computer terrorism? Will that be because of some kind of cyber attack? And the same book of Ezekiel has a long passage that talks about the United States, or, you know, Israel in biblical prophecy, being betrayed by its lovers, by its allies, by those people that it trusts, you know, inviting them in, having a close relationship with them, and then those allies turning around and stabbing them in the back. And this is, you just look about just about every security analyst in the United States. They're not particularly worried about Europe, at least not in the short or even medium term. They could say, well, maybe in the long run, Europe and Germany might be a threat. They're rich. They have the resources to be incredibly powerful. They've got a lot of separate militaries, put them together, and they're powerful. But they look at them at the moment as an American ally. The Bible talks about a stab in the back, an attack coming from one that America regards as an ally, one that they're completely not expecting anything from. There's a blind spot there, which is what makes Europe incredibly dangerous. You know, you've got a rich and prosperous country that, you know, fine on paper, their military might not be as impressive as America's. But if you're not expecting an attack from that quarter, that it doesn't take much to threaten you. And so, you know, these Bible prophecies, you say specifically, there's an attack from an ally coming, and you see America, you know, totally blind for that, exactly the way that the Bible forecasts. So this is why we're watching it. And that article, America's Achilles Heel and Germany, will go into much more detail as to how you can see this building even today.
We also have an article that is in preparation by our writer Josue Michels, Germany's Cyber Command, learning about America's Achilles Heel. You can watch for that on the website coming soon and read that article by Gerald Flurry for more information about this. Thanks very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at more riots in America following the announcement of the investigation into the death of Breonna Taylor. And other stories. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Well, people set on stoking race war in America got another excuse to take to the streets this week when results from the investigation into the police shooting of a black woman in Kentucky were announced. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the protests are already quite widespread. There have been demonstrations in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia, in Chicago, in Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, Oakland, and other major cities. The protest in New York has already threatened violence, chanting an eye for an eye. Portland has gotten to the point where protesters are throwing Molotov cocktails at the police. And two police officers have actually been shot in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, the Louisville protest, I think that's the only two with deaths, and that makes sense because Louisville is the city where Breonna Taylor was killed. And the protests were over the grand jury decision regarding the officers in that case. One of the officers was charged with three felonies regarding reckless endangerment, but the other two officers were not charged with anything. And that's the alleged reason that you're having protests in all these cities, is they're saying that, well, all three officers should have been charged with murder instead of one with reckless endangerment. And then two others not being charged. But as is the case with so many of these riots, what happened to Breonna Taylor was a tragedy, But the people rioting aren't actually looking very closely or are deliberately ignoring the facts of what happened in order to stir up protest and rioting and looting. When you look back, Breonna Taylor was killed in March. She, when you're, the details have come out in the grand jury decision, where she had been dating a drug dealer. The police got a warrant to search their apartment. They came to the apartment at night, knocked on the door, and announced it was the police. Didn't hear anything, so got a battering ram and knocked down the door. And once that happened, the lead police officer was shot in the leg from a bullet coming from the inside of the apartment. And so they started shooting back, and Breonna Taylor was killed. But looking at the details from the grand jury, what happened is that Breonna Taylor, she'd broken up with the drug dealer she was dating, and there was... she was dating someone else who was in the apartment with her. So he wasn't expecting a police raid in the middle of the night. He probably expecting his girlfriend's crazy ex-boyfriend to show up at some point. So when he heard a battering ram knocking down his door in the middle of the night, he shot at whoever was coming through the door, hit the police officer. The police officer was, were feeling they were under attack and started shooting back. I guess they shot 22 bullets into the apartment, all of which missed the guy who actually shot the police officer. But 11 of those bullets, which hit Breonna Taylor, who was not the one who was looking for anyway. So it was all a really big and unfortunate misunderstanding. The man who shot the police officer wasn't charged with anything. The black man, the boyfriend, the new boyfriend, because it was ruled self-defense because he was just someone was breaking into his house at night and he wasn't sure who it was. The one of the police officers, they found just like blindly shot 10 bullets through a screen door where he couldn't see anybody on the other side. And so he was charged with reckless endangerment. You're like, yeah, your friend was shot, but you just like pulled guns and started shooting helter-skelter into an apartment where you didn't know who was in there. The other two, it found out, was a little bit more targeted at we're trying to defend ourselves from the guy who just shot me in the leg. And so even though there weren't any drugs in the apartment and the drug dealer they were looking for wasn't even there that night, those two were let off. And I think the, so like Breonna Taylor's family, they got like $12 million in compensation from the state. So big misunderstanding, but the jury, it's all went through very legal and very well thought out as to the felony charges that were laid here, and definitely not justification for throwing Molotov cocktails for police in Portland, right. Portland, Oregon, who have nothing to do with anything even regarding this case.
Yeah, it's an excellent example of a complete lack of faith in the justice system to be able to handle a case like this, and the kind of preordained conclusion that anything short of a complete murder charge and incarceration or whatever punishment would be due in those circumstances is a miscarriage of justice that is completely the result of inherent racism within the system. So,
right, you could definitely see how the family would be upset in a complicated case like this. But like I said, most the people protesting and rioting in these cities, like I said, if they looked at the case, they realize, okay, there is some this is a tragic case, but it's not the result of systematic racism. I mean, even the grand jury has been accused of like racism and sexism against black women, despite the fact that like no one even knew about Breonna Taylor was even in the apartment until they found her dead, because the bullets had so they didn't know whether it was a woman or a man. It was just a bullet came out of a door and a bullet went and 22 bullets went into the door.
But really, the I guess the bottom line of all of this is we're back to more rioting and race-related rioting and anger and bitterness that is just continues to escalate in this country.
Right. Coming right on the heels of all the George Floyd protests, this is just becoming more a permanent feature of American society. And I mean, the article we'll put in the show notes from our editor-in-chief, is Race Riots Were Prophesied, that goes through a number of scriptures. I mean, probably highlighting most of all the one we mentioned earlier about Isaiah 1 and verse 7 about your cities will burn with fire, strangers will devour it in the midst of you. And that term strangers, just Isaiah was writing to an Israelite audience, so he's talking about like non-Israelites who live in among the Israelites will be burning cities as really punishment from God for the sins of the society. And then, of course, the longtime listeners of this show know that end time Israel is the United States and Britain. So now you're looking at racial minorities in the United States and Britain burning and throwing Molotov cocktails and rioting. And it's, yeah, it's all very destructive. It's been going on all summer, all summer, but it was prophesied in that verse 2,500 years ago.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. As we spoke about on Wednesday's program, the Abraham Accords that we talked about in the first half are uniting the rival factions of the Palestinians. More impressive evidence of that occurred this week. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, on Thursday, the rival factions of Fatah and Hamas were meeting up in Turkey, and they were going to try and press forward more with the reconciliation between the two groups that hasn't existed for over a decade. And they announced on Thursday that they are going to press ahead and have elections, parliamentary elections, and presidential elections. So not only are they going to come together and form a united body, but those seats for the Palestinian parliament and for the president that is currently held by Mahmoud Abbas, they are going to be up for grabs as well. And as I said, this is the first time that it's happened since 2006. At that time, you'll remember, or most people remember, that Hamas, the more militant faction that is sponsored by Iran, that group won in an absolute landslide in the parliamentary elections, which everybody was surprised by since they are the more violent of the two groups. And yet the people, the Palestinians themselves, voted in Hamas, and then the result was not accepted by the Palestinian Authority, or let's say Fatah, the PLO, the leadership that continued from Yasser Arafat. They did not accept that Hamas would be in power. And that's when you had a split from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Both of those places were ruled from Ramallah inside the West Bank originally. But since that time, you've had Hamas ruling over the Gaza Strip, over about 1.5 million Palestinians. And then the rest of the millions of Palestinians inside the West Bank are ruled over by Fatah. And now it seems that they are finally going to come together and have elections. We'll see if they are free and fair. Hamas doesn't trust Fatah to hold free elections inside the West Bank, but they have deemed that somehow they are going to try and go ahead with this. Perhaps there's going to be international bodies that come in and oversee the election, especially in the West Bank, because Hamas has longed for power in that territory. They've actually fought against Hamas for power in that territory, but now it seems hard to see that Fatah would just roll over and let Hamas take it over in a democratic election. However, that really pressed up against the wall, not receiving, they've lost 85% of their funding in the past year from Arab states because they're not willing to deal with Israel and negotiate with Israel or President Trump. And the Arab League says, hey, if you don't come together and form one united faction, stop bickering amongst yourselves, you're not going to get any support from us. And so at least it looks like they're making overtures towards one another, and a concrete step to show that that is happening would be elections. And so they've given themselves a timetable of the next 6 months to accomplish this.
It's hard to see Hamas actually moderating itself to the point where it would be considered a part of a legitimate Palestinian government. It seems like if this does come together, and there are still a lot of questions about this, that it would result in a considerable radicalization of the Palestinian government.
Yes, it would. It would definitely. And that's what the big fear from Israel's standpoint has been, is to create a Gaza inside the West Bank,
right,
which routinely use has terrorists. Well, Gaza, obviously, they have access to the missiles and such, and they fire them into Israel on almost a weekly basis. 2 weeks ago, they fired 13 more. You didn't hear about that, but that's what Hamas was doing from the Gaza Strip inside Israel. And so what happens if you put that same power that is a party to or is led by Iran inside the West Bank? Then it creates, on the doorstep of the West Bank, East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem, creates a much greater threat for Israel. There would be questions of what weapons they could get in there, of course. They wouldn't have, it would be more difficult to smuggle such weaponry in there. But nevertheless, you would see a radicalization of the Palestinians at the hands of Hamas inside the West Bank, which is a much more dangerous or much more difficult area for Israel to police. It's a huge border, and the West Bank has a huge border on going into Israeli territory. It's not like the Gaza Strip. There's many Jewish communities that live right in the middle of the West Bank, like Gush Katif, the before they exited the Gaza Strip. And so it'd be a much more difficult and dangerous area for Israel, to Israelis to live in this territory. And so would it actually happen? Would Israel accept a Palestinian authority ruled by Hamas? Up to this point, they've said, no, we're not going to accept terrorists on our doorstep and have to negotiate a Palestinian state with terrorists. We're not going to do it. However, it seems like if the Palestinians and Hamas were to come together, Fatah and Hamas were to come together, and maybe they do have some type of, like, truce for a little bit or a period in which they aren't attacking Israel, and they accept part of Trump's peace plan or coming together with Israel of negotiations, you could see Israel being put in a tight spot here, having to negotiate the deal of the century that President Trump wanted. Now, that's a few steps down the line, but we know in terms of biblical prophecy that we are going to expect a radicalization of the Palestinians inside the West Bank. So we have expected for about 20 years a Hamas takeover of the West Bank. And when they come together and they announce that they're going to have elections, then you have to consider that last time this happened, Hamas won in a landslide, not just inside the Gaza Strip, but also inside the West Bank, but they were never allowed to rule. And so it's hard to see that you wouldn't have a similar judgment by the Palestinian people, fed up with the just rank corruption of Abbas, Yasser Arafat, and Fatah inside the West Bank, and they would be ready for a change as well.
Well, if you want more information about the prophecy regarding what's to happen here, read our booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy. We'll link to it in the show notes. You can find it in our literature library as well. And thank you for that, Brent. China's human rights abuses are being increasingly well documented. Evidence emerged this week that the Uyghurs aren't the only people it's committing to internment camps. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we've spoken several times on the Trumpet Hour, even on the Wednesday episode this week, about Xinjiang and the Uyghurs, as you just mentioned, there in the northwestern part of China, and just about the dystopian detention centers that the Chinese Communist Party is operating. They're holding and indoctrinating and, in many cases, torturing more than 1 million ethnic minorities there. And a new report was published this week showing that it's also happening in Tibet. So Tibet is quite similar to Xinjiang in a number of ways. The region was invaded and annexed by China in 1950. Its people, like the people of Xinjiang, are ethnically and linguistically and religiously different from the main people of China, the Han people. And then also, like the people of Xinjiang, most of the Tibetan people would like to be free from China. They would like for their region to be autonomous. So there has been just a lot of frictions in Tibet. And now China appears to be using the same solution that it has used in Xinjiang, just to better subdue the region. There's a report that came out this week, and it says that they've now got 500,000 Tibetans who have been forced into military-style training centers. And in these camps, these people are, they face enforced indoctrination, intrusive surveillance, and all kinds of harsh punishments for resistance. So I think this just shows that China has been pleased with the success of its brutal programs there in Xinjiang, and now they're using a very similar model in Tibet. But this This is important to watch because there's a Bible prophecy in the Gospel of Luke that says in the end time, shortly before the end of this era, a new epoch called the Times of the Gentiles would begin. And Mr. Fleury, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, wrote an article about this era in the July 2014 issue. It's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And he explains that the term Gentile can really describe any non-Israelite people, but the context of this prophecy shows that it really refers to two specific groups. One of them revolves around Germany, and the other one revolves around Russia and China. So, you know, when we see China today just becoming more and more powerful under the Chinese Communist Party and more just abusive of that power in places like Tibet, we really get a picture of how dark and how turbulent the times of the Gentiles will be. So for anyone who would like to understand that in the prophetic context, I would strongly recommend What Are the Times of the Gentiles?
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. We're going to finish with a couple of stories about corruption in the United States government. The first about the court case against General Michael Flynn that revealed some chilling details about the FBI. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, I think in some ways this is almost an astonishing story. For a long time, there's been this big debate. Did the Obama administration spy on President Trump and do anything illegal? And of course, President Trump's campaign has said, absolutely, they spied on us. It was all completely illegal. Whereas all of Mr. Obama's people have said, no, it was fine. It was done constitutionally. There was absolutely nothing wrong with this. What we got yesterday were a series of texts released from inside the FBI showing that the people who were conducting the investigation knew that it was illegal. They were talking about how they were all buying professional liability insurance because they knew that they were at risk of getting sued or going to jail because of what they were doing. You know, a lot of the people on the ground were saying, we can't believe the higher ups are telling us to do this. We can't believe that we're keeping on going on this. I mean, I won't use all of the language that they used. It was a bit on the off-color side. But they knew that they were getting themselves into big, big trouble by keeping on going with this investigation. The text messages come from a whole range of time. Some of them comes from before the election. One of the texts, this was from August 11th, said, for example, doing all this election research, I think some of these guys want a Clinton presidency. You know, they could see that this research and this FBI investigation was all about trying to go out and get to hamper President Trump, to support President Clinton. And then it was after the election and President Trump won, that's when they all started getting worried. That's when they all started, you know, being almost disbelieving that the higher ups were pushing them to keeping on going on this, knowing that it was Mr. Obama's people would soon be gone and Mr. Trump's would soon be in. One of them even texted, Trump was right, you know, talking about doing all these illegal spyings. I don't think there can be any doubt anymore in anybody's mind that what was going on there was absolutely illegal. And, you know, really, this should be this should have been on the front page of a lot of newspapers this morning, but I didn't see it anywhere on New York Times and some of those other press. But you know, we've been saying this at The Trumpet for several months. Trumpet editor-in-chief has been publishing articles talking about how this is a critical story to watch. You know, sometimes because it gets into all of these Steele dossiers and things like that, it can be a kind of a harder story to follow. It's important to put in the effort. It can be, but it can be a harder one to follow. This just makes it so simple and clear. You know, the people doing the investigation, now it's obvious they knew what they were doing was illegal. All of this comes from the investigation into Michael Flynn. It shows what's going on. And Mr. Fleury talks about this. There's a series of landmark Trumpet printed articles. We've got our book Great Again that gets into some of this. And it's important to follow because there is just a very critical prophetic aspect to this whole story. You know, that there's a spiritual angle to everything that's happening. You know, the Bible talks about the devil. The Bible talks about God having a plan for the world, for Britain, for America, the devil fighting against this plan. And that's really, there's an important spiritual angle behind a lot of what is happening here as well, that just, you know, you get into what the Bible says about it, and it really brings the Bible alive and shows how relevant it is to political and world events going on right now.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. That transitions right into our final story, another that the media have been utterly disinterested in. Startling revelations this week about Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's son. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this story is really connected pretty closely to the one Richard just talked about. All the effort, all the illegal effort the Obama administration was going to in the Michael Flynn case was about framing Donald Trump and his campaign for crimes they didn't commit, framing them for illegal business ties with Russia and colluding with Russia to steal the 2016 election. And after that didn't pan out for them, they shifted to trying to impeach President Trump for allegedly trying to pressure the Ukrainian government into investigating Joe Biden's son, Hunter. Well, now the Senate has actually come out with an 87-page report detailing names, dates, business contacts, basically proving that most of the crimes that they were trying to frame Donald Trump for, the Biden family was actually guilty of. It was like a classic blame-shifting maneuver where you're like, say, well, find out all the corrupt things the Obama administration was up to, and then try to deflect blame away by framing the incoming presidential administration for doing just that. I mean, this 87 pages, I won't get through it all in the remaining time of this program, but it basically was revealing how Hunter Biden, he was sitting on the board of several companies in China and Kazakhstan and Russia and Ukraine, and getting paid millions of dollars, I think up to $4 million, for not even really doing anything for those companies. From what it looks like is like they're paying him this money at the same time his dad is vice president, and then the Obama administration is giving these nations political favors. I guess one example is Hunter Biden was on the board of a company that was doing business in Kazakhstan at the same time when, like, the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden were approving the purchase of the Uranium One the Uranium One mines in Kazakhstan. They also have, like, a $1 million transfer made to Hunter Biden from the wife of a former corrupt mayor of Moscow. Money transfers made from companies linked to, like, sex trafficking rings in Eastern Europe. And so just really deep, deep levels of corruption, and the same type of corruption that they were trying to blame.
That was in the Steele dossier.
In the Steele dossier. And, of course, the difference was the Steele dossier is like, hey, Christopher Steele talked to a Ukrainian lawyer who talked to a unanimous thinking buddy in Russia who said Trump did some vague corrupt things, where here you've actually got – this was the company, this was the monetary amount, this was the transaction, like actual proof that, what they were trying to blame President Trump for was things they were actually guilty of. And we'll definitely be looking more into this in the time ahead. Lee Smith, he's an amazing investigative journalist. He's written a new book called The Permanent Coup, which is a sequel to his book, The Plot Against the President, which really outlines the corruption in the Obama administration in an amazing way. And he even has a chapter in the new book about basically America's political elite deliberately selling their country out to China in return for access to Chinese markets and Chinese labor. Like Trump talks all the time about like millions of jobs going to China. And then these political elites get monetary favors and products produced at a fraction of the cost. And this report about Biden, that was another company, even a U.S. defense company, where he's like selling defense technologies to the People's Liberation Army in return for money. And so it gels really well with what Lee Smith is talking about the Biden family selling American defense technology to the Chinese, weakening, which is America's military advantage on the world scene in return to just enrich themselves, which just really does bring to mind like the Isaiah 1 verses 4 through 7. We already quoted Isaiah 1 verse 7 earlier about the rioting in the cities, but the lead up to that is talking about how the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint, and you're saying that that's really one of the root cause behind the riots we see is just the level of sickness and corruption in the U.S. government. And I guess if you've got time to read 87 pages, that new Senate report on the Biden family really does just bring that prophecy into vivid detail.
It's hard to say what's worse, the crimes that were committed by those politicians and their families, or the fact that the media is completely uninterested in looking into this or reporting what is happening here. You know that if roles were reversed, if this were someone in Donald Trump's family, that this would be banner news on every media outlet out there. We will link to an article that we have on the website by our editor-in-chief, Why All These Scandals. We thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Franklin. At 20 years of age, the will reigns. At 30, the wit. At 40, the judgment. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.